Good morning, everyone. Here is the latest news reported for you this Sunday morning by our staff correspondents at home and abroad. We have news from the Far East in just a moment, but let's switch first to neutral Sweden. David Anderson reports from Stockholm.
New York, this is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. Although Sweden is still a neutral country,
ladies and gentlemen, we regret that the reception is such that we have to forego the broadcast from Stockholm this morning. However, we have the latest news from our newsroom here in New York. There has been no news from Java in over 24 hours. At 7:55 Eastern Wartime yesterday, that was yesterday morning, the military radio at Bandung, Java, shut down. And since that time, there has been no news of the Netherlands Indies. Nothing except a belated Aneta agency dispatch telling of the Japs breaking through the last major defenses around Bandung, the military base and Dutch provisional capital in the west-central Java. The Aneta dispatch indicated that Allied forces intended to retire to the upland plains around Bandung. But it added that any long defense in these uplands was questionable, that enemy pressure was enormous, and that the Japs have complete freedom to bring up whatever reinforcements they want, and the Japanese have complete mastery in the air. The fate of Allied forces in Java is unknown, of the Dutch, Americans, and British Imperials. Perhaps there shall be little news for days. The last word of the Bandung radio were these: "We are now shutting down. Goodbye till better times. Long live the Queen." In the Aneta dispatch lies the obituary notice of a gallant struggle to save some portion of the Netherlands Indies as a base of Allied operations. Aneta recalls that the Netherlands Indies took the offensive against the Japanese from the very opening of the war. The Dutch struck and spared no forces. The policy of aggression was such that the strength of the Indies might have been quickly exhausted. But, says Aneta, this policy was taken in the expectation that reinforcements would soon arrive in the Far East. The Dutch agency declares that agreements which made this likely had actually been concluded, but these reinforcements never came. The Aneta dispatch continues with these words: "The tragedy now being enacted becomes heart-rending when one recalls that a great part of the Dutch Air Force was lost in the unavailing defenses of Malaya. In the Indies, there has been criticism of the Allies. Judgment will be softer now that Dutchmen are fighting in the same circumstances as did the Allies in Malaya," so says Aneta. Dispatches from Burma indicate that the Japanese may soon take the city of Pegu, some 50 miles north of Rangoon. The heaviest British tank support, combined with aerial attacks, is said to be unavailing against superior numbers of Japanese troops driving against the city from the east and the north. Jap troops are swarming across the Sitang River in heavily reinforced numbers. The British tell of heavy fighting, with the Allies laying down mortar barrages. But they add that the Japanese still come on. Allied airmen are battling to stem the advance by repeated attacks on Japanese supply lines and troop concentration points. If Pegu falls, say the British, the next step in the Japanese advance is expected to be an attempt to cut the junction of highways leading northward out of Burma. And that would leave Rangoon practically isolated. Cairo. Allied sources in Cairo say the Vichy government has known that a Japanese military and naval mission is surveying the French island of Madagascar. The strategic island lies off the eastern coast of southern Africa. It would make an ideal operation base for Japanese subs and planes marauding along the merchant shipping lines from the Atlantic to the Indian Oceans. Cairo sources say the Japs have been surveying Madagascar for the establishment of Nipponese naval and air bases for the past 6 weeks, and that the Japanese group arrived in Madagascar with the full consent of local French and Petain government authorities. The visit is said to have been approved by the French under the pressure from Berlin. Acquisition of bases in Madagascar would give the Japs control of both the eastern and western waters of the Indian Ocean. The only tenable route in the Eastern Hemisphere now open for the shipment of British supplies to the Far East. Military observers in Cairo foresee the possibility of free French forces turning the tide of battle in North Africa. The Gaullist soldiers have struck northward from French possessions below Libya. They've penetrated the great Fezzan Desert in a striking threat against Axis Tripoli. The French attack strengthens United Nations supply lines across the African continent from Douala in French Equatorial Africa all the way to Cairo. The Free French are credited with taking Axis positions in the Fezzan Desert and another Axis position in the British fighting area of Libya. Meanwhile, British Axis activity is limited to patrol operations some 80 miles west of Tobruk. Well, now for another on-the-spot report from overseas, we turn to London and the report of John McVeigh.
This is London. London has had no news from Java since communications were broken yesterday, and there's no confirmation here of the Japanese claim that leaders of the defending forces have asked them to cease hostilities on all fronts. RAF bombers last night attacked the German base at Saint-Nazaire on the French coast. One plane is missing. British correspondents in America have been sending home reports of the growth of a demand for action and attack among the American people. Over here, you can see another stirring of that same feeling among the British. A feeling that there have been too many retreats and too many defeats. A feeling that somehow, somewhere, the British must hit at the enemy. The old comforting thought that time was working for the democracies has been quietly laid to rest by most people here, and the confident predictions of some British statesmen about hanging on until we're ready to take the offensive a couple of years from now no longer impresses a nation that has watched Malaya and Java. A military authority of the stature of General de Gaulle talks of the importance of the offensive spirit in using the arms you have, says the tanks, men, and guns used to guard England might be used to carry the war onto the continent, that our arms are no good to us unless we can hit with them. Field Marshal Lord Milne is another authority who believes in attack. He says today that the British have paid in blood for following blindly the belief that defense can win. Talking of Singapore, he says that never before in the history of the British Empire have 73,000 British troops hauled down their colors on the field of battle. If we are to win this war, he goes on, every man, woman, and child in the country, from the top to bottom, must be taught to be a ruthless, 100% fighting citizen of a fighting nation. Lord Milne praises the Russians and says if Britain is to help them and herself, the British must launch an attack at the right place and with the right means. John Gordon, editor of the Daily Express, is another British commentator who calls for an offensive policy. He says that because of the greatest mass paralysis since Genghis Khan, 200,000 Japanese conquered 30 million people in Malaya in 3 weeks, and 150,000 Japanese are conquering 40 million people in Java in even less time. Gordon declares that to achieve a spectacular victory with 150,000 men, you must have them directed by men electrified by the spirit of the offensive. And he adds, the defensive mind can't do it. It dithers in indecision and is too late in action. We shall be wise to admit one plain fact. We haven't fought one really successful battle against the Germans or the Japanese in this war, and we are now in the third year of it. Gordon declares Britain blundered by not attacking Germany in the West the moment war broke out, by not smashing Italy out of the war when the fruit was ready to be plucked, and by not challenging Japan the moment she began to move into Indochina. And he says if Britain is to survive this war, she must awaken the offensive spirit that, he says, gets us a step in front of our enemy instead of invariably a step behind. This is John McVeigh in London, returning you to New York.
And here are reports reaching our New York newsroom from Moscow. Moscow this morning tells of smashing a big German counterattack. A Soviet communique declares that the Nazis have brought fresh troops from the deep rear for 2 days, concentrated them for an assault against a Russian-held town on the Central Front, and then fell back defeated, leaving hundreds of dead strewn across the fields. Red Army artillery and machine gun fire is credited with slashing the Nazis to ribbons. The Russians then launched an offensive in turn, and Moscow says the Germans fell back, and that the Red Army, pressing forward, took 2 towns. The Soviet Information Bureau announces that in 4 months of operation, several Ukrainian guerrilla detachments have annihilated more than 1,700 Axis soldiers and officers. Soviet patriots blew up over 30 trucks and 40 ammunition and food carts along with fuel trucks, a railroad bridge, a dynamite dump, bakeries, and a flour mill. All this, remember, is the work of guerrilla fighters working on their own. Moscow says guerrillas on another front burned a large provisional depot on the 9th German Division. Their trophies include 21 heavy machine guns, 2 submachine guns, 15 trucks, and 2 cars with valuable staff documents. And from Bern, Switzerland, we hear the Red Army employing new striking tactics. German dispatches to Bern admit that Russian columns fighting far behind the German lines are striking effectively at Nazi supply trains even before the trains reach the forward Nazi positions. The Germans are quoted as saying, "Even moving troops to the front is now considered a major battle in itself." The Berlin dispatch admits that mechanized battles have disrupted Nazi positions at several places and that there no longer is a continuous connected line of battle on the Russian front. Well, now for word direct from our own nation's capital, we take you to Washington.
The Navy radio is humming with messages today as Navy Secretary Frank Knox attempts to track down the persons responsible for disclosing the movements of an American convoy in the Pacific. A correspondent for the London Daily Mail, traveling with a unit of the Pacific Fleet, yesterday sent a graphic description of conditions and equipment aboard an American convoy steaming toward the Pacific War Theater. The Navy Secretary says that the story is being checked, and he added, the case is being taken up with the British authorities. The principal topic of discussion in the Capitol this morning is the possibility of a shakeup in the War Production Board. Authoritative sources are saying that a rift is developing between Donald Nelson and his production director, W.H. Harrison, because of the latter's statement that he fears President Roosevelt's shipbuilding program may fall behind schedule because of lack of materials. Nelson, on the other hand, has refused to even recognize the possibility of such a delay. He's declared that the president's goal, 8 million tons of shipping this year, must and will be achieved. It is, of course, quite likely that the 2 conflicting statements which started the controversy will also end it. However, many Capitol observers hold to the opinion that the war production chief will not tolerate the thought of failing to achieve the production goals which President Roosevelt set in his message to Congress on January 6th. They claim that anyone who holds such an opinion has, in Nelson's eyes, no place in the WPB setup. These same observers point out that Nelson's statement about increasing the goals can be construed as a direct slap at Harrison. Nelson told reporters yesterday that rather than failing to achieve the 8 million tons of shipping this year, the board was actually trying to go beyond it. And it's hinted that the new figures might be 9 million tons this year and as much as 15 million during 1943. In the meantime, the urgency of war needs in other fields has been emphasized by the War Production Board's order of yesterday, which halts the manufacture of civilian radios and phonographs on April 22nd. However, Production Board officials have announced that there will be no attempt at rationing. All sets will be sold on a first-come, first-served basis. And in this connection, even the manufacturers of pinball machines and jukeboxes will be hit by the conversion to war industries. It's just been announced that the companies which manufacture these 2 devices will turn their attention to the making of parts for Army Signal Corps radio sets. In the meantime, the long-awaited showdown between President Roosevelt and the Congressional Farm Bloc is expected tomorrow. Administration leaders in the House of Representatives hope to dispose of the Agriculture Appropriation Bill by tomorrow evening, but they still face a battle over the question of selling surplus commodities at prices below parity. President Roosevelt and Agriculture Secretary Claude Wickard have both gone on record as favoring such a move and have said that farm efforts to obtain parity prices for agricultural products will lead to inflation. Another controversial section of the bill is the proposed $450 million appropriation for soil conservation payments. Members of Congress who gladly vote every penny that the president asked to prosecute the war have balked at voting the full sums requested for non-military spending. And so, from the nation's capital, that's all for now.
And that's the news up to this moment. You've heard John McVane in London and reports from our newsroom in New York and Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.